The Guardian.
You're listening to a Guardian Live event. The Guardian has always been a community of readers, journalists, and contributors. And now our live events are bringing these people together.
The Guardian events are The Guardian at its best, which is a two-way conversation involving the reader and having a real, genuine, thriving debate.
Could be anything from food and culture, arts, to politics, to foreign affairs. Guardian members can attend from the very serious to the quite frivolous.
Support The Guardian's independent journalism and experience it firsthand. To see what events are coming up and to check out the benefits of membership, go to members.theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Live podcast, dedicated to all our live events. This Guardian Live event, Is Big Money Ruining Football, was recorded at The Guardian in March 2015 and chaired by The Guardian's David Goldblatt.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for coming. It's a great pleasure to be with you here this evening to answer the ginormous question, is big money ruining English football? And with me this evening to discuss it, I have Duncan Draslow, who is a research chemist, then a web designer of some kind or another, and now an autodidact of corporate law and its relationship with football, who is currently tasked with the Sisyphean process of turning Manchester United into a supporters' own club. He is the chief executive of the Manchester United Supporters Trust and the recent author of some really interesting proposals on the reform of corporate law. To my left, I have Pat Nevin, international and professional footballer. I'm trying to remember them all. Clyde, Tranmere, Everton, Chelsea, Motherwell. I think I probably missed one, plus Scotland. In his post-football life, he has the extraordinary combination of punditry on the radio, on the television, in print. He's got the best part of a degree in business studies, and he is, of course, a mega DJ. And on my far left, I have Damian Collins, Conservative MP for Folkestone and Hythe, one of the main figures in pushing football reform and governance within the House of Commons, a member of the Select Committee on Culture, Media and Sport, and one of the key movers in creating Change FIFA Now, a broad global coalition of parliamentarians and football administrators taking on the equally Sisyphean task of trying to reform the Mordor of global football and bring a modicum of transparency and democracy to the murky world of FIFA. So without further ado, because we're often accused at these events at The Guardian of not answering the question, I'm going to ask each of the participants to directly answer the question of the evening. Then I'm going to ask one supplementary question to them. And then I'm going to open the floor to you guys. We've got 90 minutes. I hope you will all ask as many questions as possible. Stick your hands in the air. We'll try and let everybody have an opportunity. So, Duncan, is big money ruining English football?
I'm more concerned what Sisyphean tasks means, but as long as you don't ask me that. Money per se isn't the problem, I don't think, but I think that the growth in revenue in football has attracted probably the wrong kinds of owners. And in particular, you've got owners that are looking to use football clubs as a cash cow because there's so much money now flowing around in football, particularly from the TV deals. Or alternatively, you've got reckless gamblers like you've seen at Leeds or Portsmouth, where they effectively allow the club to be, gamble with the future of the club in order to try and get into the Premier League and get on the gravy train, if you like, or to get up the Premier League and get into Europe, etc. And so I think that what we really need to see is I don't think the FA can do anything because the FA is conflicted by the fact that it's got so much influence from the Premier League and people on the executive board. And so what we really need to see is some sort of government legislation to kick off a process of reform. But in short, the answer is yes and no. It's not money's the problem, but it does cause problems indirectly, I think, in terms of the types of owners and the type of behaviour that it encourages.
Pat, are problematic owners the only thing that's ruining English football? What else is going on?
Well, there's plenty of things that are ruining it. I can come back to you in problematic owners because I worked for a problematic owner when I was chief executive of a club in Scotland, Motherwell. The problems with the question, really, is money ruining football, or has it ruined football? From a pragmatic standpoint, from an economic standpoint, well, no, is the answer. Because of, you can look at a huge list of positives that have come in for the money that's come in. Stadiums are better, without even a shadow of doubt. The facilities are a million times better. And that goes from not just the playing grounds that we play on just now, but the training grounds, facilities for young development players, medical facilities. There are a whole bunch of things that have got loads and loads better. Morally and philosophically, I'm slightly different. I think playing for the joy and for the love of the game, which is the reason why I played it. I didn't play it to be famous. I didn't play it to make money. For the pure love of playing football, the creation was much more interesting to me than even the winning, to be fair. So from my point of view, yeah, that kind of playing for pure love, for all the many players who'll see it, there's not that many doing it out there, and there's not that much smiling going on in the middle of it. So it has been ruined in that way, that you will see much more cheating now. People will do anything to win. And it takes the, and if anyone comes up to me and says to me the phrase, oh, I can't watch it now, just rolling and diving about. You go and look at rugby at the weekend there, and it was fabulous, getting into each other and getting up and behaving like real men, which immediately drew me to the person I met today, Emma Hayes, who is the manager of the ladies' football team. And she was saying, and I was saying how much I actually enjoy women's football more than men's football a lot of time, because no one dives, no one rolls about, no one tries to get anyone sent off. They do it for the love of it. And then I said to her, is it going to change? And she said, yeah, if money comes in, it will. So that's the sadness. You either, it's an either or, and you can't have both. And that's the problem we've got here.
Damien.
It's an interesting question, because there are very few other walks of life where you'd ask that question. If you ran a business and you said, having more money in this business, killing the business, you'd say, no, it's on the whole, it gives us the power to do more things. And I think the reason it gets asked about football is, I think the money in football, whilst what Pat said is absolutely right, and the facilities are better, there's so many things that are better, it empowers a certain group of people within the game. And is that a healthy thing? Because if you give too much power to the players and their agents and representatives, and too much power to the commercial people, do you lose the spirit of the game in the process? And if we continue down that path, I think it is the one thing that has got the power to destroy the game. But I think the interesting thing comparing with rugby with football is not just about the money, but that is an important thing. It's just about the, I think it's about the rules and discipline within the game as well. My little boys just started playing mini rugby. But, you know, they're the things about no dissent to referees, you know, shaking hands with people you've played with. All the things that actually are part of the adult game, are part of the game that six-year-olds play as well. And somehow that's not lost. And I don't believe that's because, you know, rugby people are nicer people. I just think there's a kind of, there's a focus on those things. And the players and the individuals haven't become more powerful than the organisations that they represent. And I think that is what has started to happen in football.
OK, so that's a range of problems. We've got problematic owners, we've got a draining of the soul and the spirit, and a kind of meanness of spirit and a lack of joy. Not dissimilar for you. Let me ask you this slightly broader question, Damien. Some people would say that football is an exemplar of a successful, globalised, free market business that has fantastic export success. In this country, and you know, the current Premier League deal, 5.1 billion for domestic media rights, probably doubled with foreign rights. So let me ask this question: do you believe that there will be effective trickle down to the rest of the game? Do you think that, well, there will be a fair distribution of this money coming into the game? And if there isn't going to be a fair distribution, how might we make it fairer?
Well, there will be trickle down to an extent, because there'll be more money in the system, there'll be more people engaged in it commercially. But I think probably now running a big football club is much more like running a Hollywood studio than it is running a sports team. It's a content business. The money is in the money people pay to watch it and associated benefits that come from it. The money goes to the stars that people want to pay to see. They drive the sales of, you know, cable subscriptions and merchandise. And so I think the more money there is in that type of system, the more money goes to the stars, the people want to see. So maybe trickle under everyone else, but they're not on the same cut, you know, at all. And so I think you will see this increasing disparity. And one of the questions I think we have to ask ourselves is, whilst having more money in football is great, it's only really great if more of that money gets through to the grassroots as well. Otherwise, you know, it's only a small elite group of people are really benefiting from the money that's gone into the game.
Let me ask you this. Do you actually think it is just about the stars that people want to see. Is it not the case that the stars, if you like, you know, they create the spectacle, but what infuses it with meaning is the history of those clubs and the atmosphere that crowds generate? I mean, when one supports Manchester United, of course, one is loving watching Wayne Rooney, but one's also buying into a historical narrative of 50, 100 years of Manchester United, which is what gives it a kind of depth, makes it more than just the ball in the back of the net.
I think that's absolutely right. That's an important facet to it. And also the competition in English football as well. We have competitive leagues, you know, and that is one of its great strengths. That helps drive the commercial success. But I'm talking about the power of individuals and the money that they can attract. Now, you might look at, you know, buying Cristiano Ronaldo for 100 million, 200 million pounds is a really good deal, because you can make that money back through, you know, through shirt sales, endorsements, you know, other benefits the club might get almost instantly. So these astronomical sums are being supported by ever more money that comes in from the commercial side of the game. And there seems to be no end to it. And I think we could be seeing in the next 10 years, we could see the same rate of growth as we've seen over the last 10 years. There could be no... And then, what would it look like then? We'd still be having debates about, you know, community football pitches. And, you know, we wouldn't have solved all those grassroots issues, problems we'd like to solve for relatively small amounts of money.
Pat, I thought it was really interesting to hear you talk about all the things that are better, and I think that's really important. The football is better, the training facilities are better, as you say, the stadiums are better. Looking back at your time playing in the 1980s and early 1990s, what about the atmosphere? I mean, one of the arguments that is made is, you know, the Premier League in particular now has an average age of attendance of around 47. So that's younger than me. And I have to say, as a 49-year-old man, try as I might, I'm not the person creating the atmosphere in football stadiums. So how does it differ from when you were playing? And do you see a point where the atmosphere is actually completely disintegrated?
I'm very disappointed with... Let's talk about Chelsea, the team I played for, interestingly. Much better team now. The team I support now. I mean, I work for Chelsea TV quite a lot of times, so I'm still involved with them. We had really great atmospheres usually when we travelled to games, and there were negative sides to that atmosphere, but they were very good atmosphere. The ground we used to play in was terrible. It had a big running track around it, but still those fans tried to create an atmosphere. Now, it is the most perfectly designed, closed-in stadium, which, if you'd have brought those guys from the 80s and stuck them in that stadium, the noise would have been absolutely incredible. Whereas now, the Chelsea fans, they're good, and in certain occasions, it's explosive and it's noisy and it's phenomenal, but it's very much certain occasions. And I think that's a problem. It's not there all the time. It is a different clientele in certain football clubs around the country. I know it's actually more in the old home of the Guardian, in Manchester City. I think when I go there... I remember I used to go and play against Manchester City, and I always used to think, wow, what a place this. I love Main Road. The noise is great. Then you move to this all-purpose, all-singing, all-dancing stadium, and it's gone. And there are so many stadiums like that where, yeah, it'll be extraordinary. When Man City won the league, with that last kick of the ball and Aguero, yeah, the eruption was there. But I went to watch them against Arsenal recently. Dead, you know. So there's a variety of reasons that, yes, it's different. Some parts are as ever, some parts are better, some parts are worse. But that extreme noise level that you used to get for longer is actually harder to generate now. And I have to say it as clientele. I think it is.
Do you think it's also about sitting down?
But possibly so. I mean, by the way, I've nothing against, in many ways, the gentrification of parts of the game. I accept it as part of it, just times move on. It hurts me as a working class lad, one of six children. If my dad was bringing me up now, I used to go and see my team every week. I couldn't go now. My father couldn't take 6 weeks to go and see a game now. I may well have been lost to the game, because I grew a love of the game from seeing a beautiful team playing, you know, the great Celtic side of the 70s. And I may not have got that bug, that love, that play it for the passion kind of attitude. So people like me, with my heart and my soul, may not be dragged into the game. On the other side of it, lots of people are coming who haven't got that kind of hard-line background, but are seeing other things in it. I mean, someone said to me, and again, I don't want to make this all class-driven, which it shouldn't be, but it's quite common that if a coach is looking for a young player, and he's got two, and one's a working-class lad and one is a middle-ish class lad, you go for the middle-class lad every time then. that shocks a lot of people, that because you think the working class lads get thinking of the fight, the battle, whatever. Not the way they think about it now. They think someone who's got an education and an understanding, knows how to work, understands about work ethic, and will be less likely to go off the rails. And that's an amazing difference in the game since I played it. So that's filtering from the stands through the clubs, etc. And that sometimes surprises a lot of people.
Duncan, Sisyphus was that poor dude in Greek myth who was cursed to roll a stone up a hill every single day, and at the end of the day, it rolls back down to the bottom and you've got to start all over again. Tell me, if the Sisyphean task at Manchester United, one, it seems to be one of the good things that's come out of the last 20 years is the emergence of the supporters' trust movement and the idea that there should be common and collective ownership of football clubs. Can you tell us what's the case? Why should football clubs, what's the case for being supporter, you know, supporter-owned? Is it a moral argument? Is it a practical argument? Why should we treat football clubs as something different from a conventional corporation?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, can I just say something about atmosphere? But it sort of relates to that. And I think that I think it's absolutely true that there is a change in the demographic of supporters, and particularly in the age profile. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And that's had a big impact. But I also think what it's about is the relationship between the fans and the club and what they feel that relationship is. And I think you could almost plot it on a graph if you plot ticket prices versus your perception of being a supporter or a customer. As the price goes up, you're converted from a supporter into a customer. And a customer isn't loyal, doesn't have non-transferable loyalty to the club. And I think that's what we're doing over a period of time, is we're turning our fanatical supporters into customers who start to pick and choose whether they're going to support the club. You know, years ago, people would be proud of the fact that they never missed a game or ever, you know, and nowadays, it's very few people like that you see anymore that will not miss a single game, because it doesn't seem to make sense anymore. We feel like because we're customers, we're actually opening ourselves up to exploitation by the club if we actually act in that ultra-loyal way. And I think that does relate to the ownership, because when Manchester United was floated on the stock exchange, it seemed absolutely natural to me. I wanted to have some shares in the club, because I felt that I was part of the club, and to own part of it as well, and for all of us to own it together felt completely natural, as the natural ultimate extension of your support, if you like, is that you are part of the club, you own the club, etc. And I think that the antithesis of that is the private owner who sees the club as a cash cow and wants to screw as much money out of the supporters as possible. In terms of the argument for supporter ownership, I mean, I don't actually believe, particularly at the biggest clubs, that you necessarily want, or indeed that it's desirable to have either 100% owned or even 50% plus one along the German model ownership. What I think is more important is that there isn't any single shareholder who has control, has overall control, because the problem is that whoever has control is in a position to exploit the club. And even if that was a supporters group, potentially someone can get control of that supporters group and abuse that position or use it, because essentially I think what you need is to put the club first, not the fans or anybody else, it's the club. And so you need to protect the club by not letting any one group or individual take control of it. And so I think that part of that solution is supporter ownership, particularly at the lower league level, where I think it makes more sense and it's more achievable. At the higher level, I think what really we need is no overall control, but ideally a supporters trust with maybe a 25% plus one
Swansea
blocking stake. Yeah, and that's an interesting example. Because Swansea, the supporters trust at Swansea has around 20-odd%, just over. But the reason that they have significant influence and have very good governance and all those sort of positive things is not because they've got 20-odd%, it's because nobody else has got more than 25. They've got a shareholder agreement in place that means no other shareholder is allowed to go over 25%. So that means that you don't need the supporters to have significant power, you just need nobody else to. And that works really well. I think that is a great example. But football clubs aren't going to do this on their own. So, you know, there's got to be some kind of external reform put in place in order to encourage clubs to change.
That's a lot of stuff to talk about. I'm just now going to turn it over to you guys. So, who has a question for us? Gentleman on the end. I think a microphone, if you could just hold on for a moment, and the microphone will be with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First of all, I wanted to say that I disagree with Pat's comment about different clientele of fans, because as someone who has a season ticket at Chelsea, not too far from the TV Gumtree where Pat's working from, those guys are exactly the people who used to come to the games in the 80s, and I'm probably one of the youngest guys sitting around them. And they go to the games because they have the habit of going. Of my friends, I'm probably one of the youngest who actually have a season ticket at the Premier League club, simply because no one else can afford it. And this is the problem, that it's not a different clientele, it's the very same clientele, but aging, who used to come to the games in the 80s, and there are no influx of so-called young blood. And this is something I think clubs, especially like Chelsea, should definitely address. And another question would be about players. I mean, that big elephant in the room that you forgot to mention, those guys who are often mentioned in the articles earning hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, you don't mention their role, what they could possibly do to change the perception of football. And I think that there might be reasons why you are afraid to mention them, even though they're the actors that we are watching on the scene.
Well, I'm delighted that you've brought them up, because I think that is a really important question. And actually, I have to say, we tried very hard to get a range of current players or recently retired players to come and speak on this occasion. And it was phenomenally difficult. You're in another category, dude. You're not just ex-player, you're ex-player plus. It's a whole difference. So what about, as an ex-chair of the PFA as well?
I thought you'd bring that one up.
What's the mood amongst the troops on these issues?
Two things. Can I take the first point first, which I think is something I've worried a lot about for a long time, the demographic time bomb, which I think is the point you're making. I think it's looked like a demographic time bomb for a long time. It was an ageing support for quite a long time, and there was a gap, a massive gap. But most fans, when I used to watch, if you were going for the average age, you were talking 22, 23-year-old, young male, you know, most that was your average, you know, bog standard fan that you're going to come there. And then probably a good percentage of them would stay there for the rest of their life, but that's where you got them from. Those guys can't afford to go anymore to a lot of the clubs. So that demographic time bomb is waiting to hit in. Recently, in the last number of years, I began to think that's not going to happen, because football has become so big. There is so much interest. It's such a beast that there is absolutely no doubt if they want to get anyone else in, tweak the price, tweak the marketing strategy, you'll get them in. It's okay. And you may well be able to do that with £5.1 billion coming in. You may be able to tweak the price when it suits and when it's needed. These are businessmen, remember, and they'll know how to do it. There is no doubt at all you can fill Chelsea Football Club. You can double the size it. You can fill it if you like. You just tweak the price. So that's pure marketing more than anything else. Right, deep breath before the football players earning. There is no moral justification for footballers earning 200,000 a year. I do understand that, and I will not argue against it. But what I will say is two things from a PFA's point of view, union's point of view. If there is a huge amount of money slopping around the game and someone's going to be earning it, who should actually be earning it? I suspect the guys who are working for it. And the guys for me who are working most for it are the guys out in the park, the guys you're going to watch. So if the money's going anywhere, I would argue them more than anywhere else. Now, if you're then going to reinvest it, that's better. Great, reinvest it in youth, development, helping other parts of society through it. Yes, we do that as a football family. Did I say that? But that's what football should do, and does it to a degree, and should probably do it more. I will not morally argue for it, but I'll say any business, banking, rock stars, accountancy, you go through them all. It's a pyramid. And at the top of that pyramid, have a wee look at the wages. And they are sky high. They're rockets. They're through the... By the way, charity chairman, exactly the same. And that's what you have to look out for. Don't point at footballers and say they're the only ones. They are just a mirror of capitalism.
Please, of course.
Just a very quick point. Do I agree with you? Of course. But the problem is that if you can allow players to keep earning and earning with all TV contracts, immediately you will start bringing all the best talent from the world, including, you know, Messi, Ronaldo and the likes, to the league, but at the expense of the local players. Therefore, it will definitely affect also the dynamics of the stands. The players will not be that related to the crowd, who will be more alienated as the customers. As a result, you will lose on the support, the atmosphere that you mentioned. The product, which is the Premier League that we're talking about, will definitely lose because you can put some mannequins on the stands.
Can I ask a question then? Have we any Arsenal fans in here?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. How do you feel about your team when they were playing absolutely brilliantly and had no British players in them at all?
It's ridiculous.
Did you like it?
Absolutely not.
Fine, ridiculous. And there you have it. And there you have it. Some people love the fact that you have got, you know, a team that's got some British players in it. Chelsea fans loved it when they had the spine of English players through the middle, particularly John Terry and, you know, Frank Lampard, very important to them. But in actual fact, there's enough supporters out there that don't care. They just want the best team. There is enough out there. To be honest, I'm a Hibernian supporter, and I quite like most of the players to be local. I wouldn't mind a wee sprinkling or a wee bit of magic dust around there. It would be really good. But that becomes a purely economic argument as well, purely economic. And I've watched it happen in Scotland, and it's happening here in England. In Scotland, we had no problem with it. We were developing good players. We got some money in through your television. We then bought in loads of foreign players. The other ones didn't develop. We hit a ceiling. The national team dived. We had a financial disaster, total catastrophe. Had to get rid of them, had no choice, had to develop our own. Have a look, we're better again. We developed our own. Sadly, everyone's exactly the same position.
Gentleman at the back.
It's interesting you brought up Scotland there, Pat, because I live in Scotland, and the last 5 years have seen a massive, I think, crash in the standard of the SPL. So if you look at, I was looking at a website today, a football data website, that basically suggests that St Mirren, who are bottom of the SPL, would come mid-table in League Two this season if they were in the English League, whereas 5 to 10 years ago, they would have performed a lot better. And one of the issues here is actually there is a question mark over whether English football and the money in it has ruined Scottish football as part of the industry, because actually all the best players in Scotland now, the first thing they want to do is move to England if they can, because there's more money. And unless you play for Celtic and you're in the Champions League, what is the point in staying in Scotland? Because the standard of the league's not up to scratch. The international team of Scotland now, you know. So the big question mark for me is actually, I just wanted to make a second point there, which is on your point earlier about players' wages, and obviously I don't blame players for the money they get. It's not their problem. I think their agents play a massive part, and the culture that's evolved through agents and the way that they deal in football, the way they work, and that has actually caused a major problem within the game. My point in this whole industry is I think it's madness that an industry where there's been so much brand loyalty from supporters such as myself who supported my local club or my club the whole of my life, I've been extorted every week for the last 20 years since I was a child to go and watch my team every week, home and away. And what do I get in response to that? In my opinion, this season, my club, Burnley, who are in the Premier League this season, its prices on average have gone up by 78% from the Championship to the Premier League. That is a massive increase in an area where people's average wage is £13,000 to £14,000 a year, right? Do the clubs care about that? I've got absolutely no doubt they don't care. If Danny Ings asked for a £10,000 a week increase in his wage, they definitely do care about that. I think there's a real cultural problem within the game, which is rewarding these individual players. I don't blame them. They're very good at what they do. They're very good at their jobs, and they're very talented. They've worked very hard for years to get to where they've got. But at the same time, there are also local communities and local supporters at every club, including the top clubs, who have followed their club year in, year out, all over the country, again and again and again, and they are getting treated like complete dirt by their clubs. And until it stops, I am hopeful that clubs in this country and individual fans will start to see the picture that's emerging. And I don't think this TV deal is going to change it at all, if I'm honest. I don't think it's going to change the model, the way these clubs operate, the way they treat their fans. And the way I see it, I was at Southampton away on the weekend. I don't know why I went. I actually went because Sean Dyche gave me one of his complimentary tickets. It's the only reason I went. If the way the football is going, there is no future in it for me as a loyal fan who goes every week, home and away. Within 5 years, I'm out of this game and my kids won't go either. And that's where I think you've got a serious issue for the next generation. If I, as a passionate local, hardcore fan who would go every week, I'm no longer thinking to go, you've got a serious problem.
Thank you. Let me ask you for practical, each of you, for practical solutions to that. Tickets are outrageously expensive. It feels like a form of rent seeking, in effect. What can practically be done about the cost of tickets in football? Damien.
Well, I think it's a good example with Burnley, because the revenues that Burnley will get from the Premier League are substantial. And I think clubs like that have got to take a long, hard look at it and say, to what extent are we dependent on ticket sales on match day for the revenue that we need to put a team on the pitch? Because if there's a kind of deal that saves the fans, that we're a smallish club, you know, if we want to be playing in the Premier League, we've probably all got to pay for that a bit, because otherwise we just can't sustain it, can't afford the wages. Or is it a question of saying, when you get up to the Premier League, do clubs say, well, you know, the demand for tickets is going up, so we'll just put the prices up to match that? If it's the latter, I think that is something that should be looked at very seriously, because I think actually the balance of money going into the top end of football is not from the fans at the turnstiles, it's from other streams of revenue. So I think it's unfair that fans should have to carry too heavy a burden in that regard, and hopefully good clubs will try and get that balance right. I mean, we always talk about Germany. There are lots of things I like about Germany, but, you know, the Bundesliga is a more commercially successful league than the Premier League. It is more profitable, has lower income, but makes more profit, and they charge less at the turnstiles, and their national team does better. So, and they've still got teams in the Champions League, which we haven't got. So
the question is how. In Germany, part of the reason for that is you've got massive supporter representation on every single board, and to be honest, a kind of football administrative ruling class that still has a sense of shame and sees football as a social and not exclusively a commercial project. So what's the practical, what's actually going to make it happen? How can we have more good clubs making good decisions?
Yeah, well, and the voice of fans within the clubs is important. You know, and I think, as Duncan said, I think that to make sure that the balance of the boards of clubs is right, so they consider the broader interests of the community life of the club, including its local fan base, when they make commercial decisions as well. I think that is the optimum. You know, I think what we'd like to see is probably a journey where clubs are helped along the way to get to that. I think it's very difficult to impose structures on football clubs, which are on the whole very different. But I think that's clearly the direction we'd like to see taken.
Duncan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's easy to argue that each football club is a monopoly, in effect, because of that non-transferable loyalty we talked about, which means that you can only get your fix from one supplier. And what normally happens in that sort of industry is that you have some sort of regulation to ensure that the consumer isn't being ripped off. We actually made this argument to the OFT in the past, and their response was that although they understood the value of our arguments, they didn't see that the size of the market justified an investigation and any kind of intervention in the market. But I think that it's clear that we need some form of regulation, because actually it'd be very easy now for clubs to reduce ticket prices without really denting revenue, because the balance of money coming in from turnstiles versus TV has shifted so greatly. And the fact that they still won't do it, or still don't do it, really tells you. I mean, we've had these discussions with the Premier League in particular, and I made this argument to Scudamore at a meeting. Why don't you ring-fence some of the cash before you redistribute it to the clubs and use it as some kind of subsidy mechanism or as a reward mechanism to the clubs that do the best in terms of looking after their fans, you know. So you might get a league table of which clubs operate the best way. You know, it's in the same way that the Premier League TV money is actually distributed according to your position in the league, for a start. And I'm not sure. I think there might be some fair play aspect to it. I'm not sure. But certainly, I think you could have an argument that the clubs that fill their ground and do so with the cheapest prices, or, you know, whatever kind of formula you want to come up with, could get some kind of financial reward out of part of that. But what his response was, believe me, I have tried, and there is no way you will get any money out of the clubs. They want it all immediately, and the only thing they will ever vote on is things that give them more money. All right, maybe I shouldn't be saying that. but that was his view, was that it's impossible to actually get the clubs to see. Because really the problem is that they all look at everything far too short term. And that's exactly why we've got the problem with the demographics in the crowd. Because what they're doing is maximising short term revenue in terms of ticket revenue. Because really what they should be doing is, we're losing fans usually about 16, 18, because that's when suddenly the price hikes up. You know, a lot of clubs have cheap prices for under 18s. But actually, most people now don't get a job at 16. Well, nobody does now, do they? I mean, you go to training or education, and then more than 50% go to college. And so basically, there isn't earning capacity there to allow people to transition from the under-18 prices. But the clubs don't care because they're not looking 5, 10, 20 years down the line. The lifetime value that Pat talked about in terms of those fans, if you keep a fan beyond the age of 22, 23, you might have them for another 40-odd years. What's the value of that? Now, that should be, in any normal business, you would say, well, let's hang on to those people. But I think because you've got so many owners that are only looking at the next 5 years or the next 3 years, they're not actually doing anything about that problem. And that's why I think it has to come from outside. Now, you might say, well, isn't this the job for the FA? And I think we've already talked about the problem we've got with the FA is that there's too much influence on the FA from the professional game, particularly in the Premier League, because of the money in the Premier League and the presence of those representatives on the FA board. But also, if you were talking about regulating ticket prices, for example, and the FA doing it within their own system, how can the FA do that when the FA have to charge extortionate prices at Wembley because they've incurred this huge debt at Wembley? So it's a crazy idea that the FA could actually fulfil that role. And so that, I think, is our problem, is that the FA cannot perform its role as the natural regulator of the game. And so, you know, I think that's why, again, we have to come back to there's got to be some kind of external intervention to kick off this reform process.
Pat, and in particular, I want to ask you, away fans, and when we're talking a lot of the time about home fans here, what about away fans in all of this?
A different type of fan. Quite often it was an away fan because, you know, season tickets have taken up. Well, by the way, the football is many different things. Football for the very, very top echelon is a different thing from the guys down at the lower echelons or the lower leagues. You know, it's almost a different beast completely. But those guys, they get the opportunity to travel. It's still expensive, but they can't afford the season tickets. So that's a different group of people. And they are seen by many as more passionate. And it often sounds more passionate as well. And I've kind of noticed in myself that that's the case. The questions you asked before, I don't want to be ignorant and ignore them. I think they were good points you made. First of all, thank you for making my point about the Scottish football stronger than I could, because yes, they are getting better. The teams aren't, because they're all coming down to England. The teams aren't, because they're all going down to England, and it's having such a big beast on your doorstep, you're stuffed. Because if you look at all the best Scottish players now, see if you move them back up for England, the Premiership, Championship, First Division, put them back in Scotland. Boy, we'd have a great league just now. We'd have a fabulous league just now, as good as we've had in decades. So there's no problem with the development of talent. That's not a problem for us. So that's nothing to worry about. I think you made the point there very, very good as well. The business argument you make not being able to go back to the games. I said it right in my first answer. If I was a kid growing up now, my father couldn't take me, and I might have been lost to the game as well. We have to get into an area here, and I think this is where you and I are. I've worked in a number of different areas in the game. It's the economy. And I won't say stupid, but you know what I mean. It is economics. Nothing else matters. And you have to find a way around that for them. You're right. They don't look at anything other than the bottom line. To some degree, they would argue they can't look at anything else than the bottom line. With FIFA fair play, you know, financial fair play coming in, they absolutely can't do that. Because if they lose that, they will fall down. They will absolutely fall down. I would make one question. I'm being devil's advocate, but somebody has to do it in here just now, right? This demographic time bomb we talk about and you losing those people, I think I've changed my mind on it now. I don't think it's going to happen. Because I go down to a lot of clubs, particularly the Premier League, if, and it's an if, it stays as popular as it is just now with a worldwide audience, you could fill almost all of those grounds with tourism. The amount of people that are travelling over in here and travel over here and buy tickets and go to see games is extraordinary. So in actual fact, that demographic that we wanted to keep, that we fought for and we wanted in to build for a future, which has always been how we've kept it in perpetuity, and it might not be the same model anymore. It might be a different model these guys are looking at. We have to kind of get our heads out of this and have a look up and see where they're coming from.
Will the Premier League stay as popular, though, if you lose the atmosphere because you've got, if you want to call it, tourists?
We have.
Well, it hasn't completely happened yet, has it?
But we have. The atmosphere isn't as good as
isn't,
it was.
Isn't there a time delay, though, before it changes?
It may be, and that's a chance they take. But that happened. All those things I felt all those things that you said, and it's not happened. and say, okay, we'll look and we'll keep on watching and see if it happens. But when I think it's going to something's going to happen, partially because I want it to happen, because I want the soul to be kept in our game, because that's why I loved
but
it for.
I think the Premier League recognise that, and it's the club owners that don't, because certainly in the conversations I've had with people in the Premier League, they're very concerned about atmosphere, you know, and they always talk about wanting to maintain occupancy, but they know that occupancy isn't the only thing, attendance, occupancy. Atmosphere is really important, and they're very aware of, especially when they're selling international rights, competition from Germany. And if you talk about German football, they get really angry about it, because they know that that is, were it not probably for the language difference, then, you know, maybe the German football would be the product that was going around the world.
I do agree with you, and I do think people do get a wee bit carried away in English football. Have a wee look back at the 80s. Everyone was looking at Italy. No one's looking there anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, if not says it's died, but in comparison to that was where it was. It's not anymore. This doesn't necessarily last forever, so they have to be careful, you're right.
I'm going to take a couple. The lady in the scarf, then the gentleman in the middle, then the gentleman down here, and then we'll come to you.
Thank you very much. Just curious to hear your thoughts about the growing trends of pension funds buying players as if they were commodities and often owning players that play against each other in different clubs in terms of ethics, obviously, modern slavery and match fixing.
Damien, I'm going to throw that one to you.
There are strict rules on, if you like, sort of third-party ownership. I think because of the reasons you alluded to in the way you asked your question, that you could have players who are tied to particular business interests. They are moved on from club to club at the interest of their owners, who are only looking to maximise the commercial return they get for that player. They're not interested in that player's development as a footballer. I think many of the broader concerns people have around, you know, money laundering in the game is linked to the way players are moved in that regard. That is something that is not just bad for football, but is bad for society as a whole, because the sort of people that get involved in that sort of business are not the sort of people you'd want to see them being involved with. I know in Eastern Europe there is, you know, there are the players groups, you know, groups like FIFPro have really spoken out about the fact they feel that certain players are almost treated like commodities by very, very powerful people who own them and move them around. And I think more needs to be done. I think more needs to be done by FIFA, I think, looking at this issue as well about the way players moved around. I mean, whilst I'll be the first to be incredibly critical of FIFA on most issues, I do think this is one that they have actually, you know, tried to tighten up the international rules on. But it is a big problem. I think we have to be very alive to, and this goes on to some of the things we've touched about already, that people with money in the game, there are some good people with money in the game, and there are some people who are just trying to make as much money out of football as they can. And the commodity market of buying and selling players for, you know, intangible amounts of money, you know, can be a market that very unscrupulous people are seeking to exploit for themselves. And, you know, we have to be very vigilant about that. And that's partly football, but also, you know, some of the international money markets who monitor bank transactions and who take an interest in things like money laundering as well. That has to be an important part of the scrutiny. I'd like to see, in many ways, some clubs be put through the same sort of ringer that some financial institutions are as well, to make sure it's all sound.
Gentleman in the middle, I had a question. I think it was you.
The question is big money ruining English football? Of course it is. We all know it. We wouldn't be here if we didn't know it. What I want to know, though, is why we don't start again. Why don't some of the big people, some of the influential people in English football, start a new football club based on the grounds of St. Pauli in Germany? Do any of you know who St. Pauli is?
Do tell us.
St. Pauli are a club. They got promoted into the Bundesliga, but they got relegated last year. So they're now in the second division of German football. They look after their local community. They look after the people of St. Pauli. I think if we could set up a club, I'm trying to do it with my friend here, but it's going to be impossible just us two. We're going to try and reach out as far as we can. Somewhere in the middle of England, so it's easily accessible to everybody. It's easily accessible via transport. Reinvest the profit into the local community. Look after people. Football isn't about money. Football should be about representation of the local community. I support Arsenal, God knows why anymore, but I still do. But so they do nothing for Islington. I was born and raised in Islington. They do nothing for Islington.
So let me ask you, why is it we do have some of that? I mean, I think of FC United or Dulwich Hamlet or a whole variety of football clubs at lower levels.
AFC Wimbledon, they are prime examples of what fans can do if they get together. I'm talking to... We just wipe it clean. We're not going to change the Premier League. This meeting is a waste of time if we want to change the Premier League. The Premier League ain't changing. It's never going to change. There's far too much money. $5 billion for TV. And like Duncan just said, they want to make more money. They don't care about anything else. They want to make more money. And Pat touched upon it as well. Foreign fans, I mean, Arsenal will sell out season tickets. I haven't been since 2008 for other reasons except the financial model. I'm not a fan of Arsene Wenger, but that's a different issue.
So let me ask the question then to you, Duncan. Should we abandon the reform of the Premier League? Is it all about just encouraging grassroots and socially minded alternatives lower down? Or actually, is there still hope at the top?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's one or the other. And obviously, it is happening in terms of fans are setting up football clubs, but that doesn't mean everyone's going to switch. I think one of the problems you've got is, as I mean, that argument about supporters becoming more like customers, the problem with it is that then they tend to congregate to whoever's winning. Everyone turns into a glory hunter, if you like. And ultimately, that means that you reinforce the model, don't you? And so the most successful club then gets the most fans, then has the most revenue, and it carries on like that. And actually, one of the advantages you've got from the Premier League is that because so much revenue is coming in from TV money, and because it's distributed in the way it is, that has sort of evened up the playing field. And I think that's actually why the Premier League is quite attractive, because there's so much competition there. You know, the lowest earners in the Premier League are earning more than a hell of a lot of the top European clubs outside the real elite. I don't think it's a matter of having to abandon, you know, the attempt to reform the Premier League. But I don't think it's going to happen from inside football. I think, you know, we've seen that happen time and time again. We've seen football being asked to reform, and it can't do it. I don't think it's possible, because of the vested interests in there have the power, and they are not going to vote. Turkey's voting for Christmas, effectively. But yeah, I think that it's very good to set up models that show the right ethos, if you like, and FC United, AFC Wimbledon, etc. have done that. But they're not going to challenge the Premier League or change it. You know, I mean, I just don't think that's going to happen, because too many people are now interested in supporting the club in order to get some sort of transfer of, you know, glory, if you like, isn't it? And so I think that both those routes should be pursued. You know, I wouldn't abandon either.
So who's the outside force that is going to, if we can't rely upon the Football Association?
It's the government, I think. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, I don't think you're going to get any government that's going to really heavily intervene in football, even though we've had commitments from successive governments of both parties or all parties. But I think what we do need to do is kick off the process with some sort of legislative reform, which then will give the FA the confidence to then start changing its rule book. But I think the best way to do it, I mean, if you don't mind, I'll just explain briefly what I think is the right way to approach it, is we can't change the ownership of our clubs easily, certainly at the top level, because it's too expensive. It's too hard for supporters to try and get the money together to buy clubs like Arsenal or Manchester United, Chelsea, even if there was a willing seller. But what we can do is we can change the way that the clubs are governed. If you look at listed companies in the UK, they have to comply with UK Corporate Governance Code, and that requires independent directors on the board. I think that's what we should have at football clubs. Independent directors, a majority of independent directors on every board of football clubs. But independent directors at football clubs who have a special duty, which is first to the club before shareholders if there's any conflict of interest. In normal circumstances, it won't impact on the way that the club operates. But if you've got an owner that wants to do something that's not in the best, and I would say long-term interests in particular of the club,
like
gambling on the future by recklessly spending like Leeds and Portsmouth did, or transferring debt like Hicks and Gillette and Blazers did, in acquisition. Changing the name, doing things that would disenfranchise or the fan base or make them feel, isolated from the club, massively hiking up ticket prices. Now, that might be good for the business, but it's good for the business short term. But long term, if you destroy your loyalty and your fan base, you've not done something that's good for the club. And so I think the idea of having independent directors, it's a bit like, you can have a private asset like a listed building, which an owner can make a profit from and use as they wish to an extent. But there are certain things that they're restricted on that they can't do. They can't knock it down or put an extension on that's not in keeping with it. And I think that football clubs are like that. They should have that kind of status as a sort of cultural asset, like a listed building status. And I think that's the way to do it. We're not talking about government intervention where they try and run the clubs or anything like that. But the FA can't do it. And so I think the way to do it is require these independent directors to be on the boards of clubs, and they have a legal responsibility and a legal liability if they don't fulfil that role. And so even though you might think, well, we're only going to get a load of stooges appointed as these independent directors, the fact is, if they don't fulfil that role of protecting the long-term interests of the club, then ultimately they could be sued or, taken to court by whoever is an appropriate body to require them to do that or to punish them and to reverse decisions. And so for me, I think that that's a kind of internal self-regulation, but it's got to be imposed externally to kick the process off.
Gentleman Maroon, gentleman I pointed to then we'll take this gentleman on the corner. Sorry, the gentleman Maroon, yeah.
It's been mentioned the short-term look of the owners of the football clubs, and that's obviously clear. You only have to look at the managerial sackings, or some of them. But the pressure on the owners at the top is such that with the finances, that the X amount of money is half a midfielder, and you're looking forward to the end of this season. That's not going to change. Now, I was going to mention, it's already been mentioned, Duncan will be very familiar with FCUM breaking away from Manchester United, of course, and other clubs. And incidentally, for the gentleman there, AFC Wimbledon gave them a lot of help in that, so there are people that you can reach out to. But with those breakaways, obviously some fans are fed up enough, not a lot, as a ratio of what fills a Premier League stadium, because we have tourism, etc. But surely, when it comes down to it, we have to have this debate over what we want from football, whether it's a commercial entity or whether we want that the soul side of things that Pat was talking about. And I think there's two answers, really. Either you say, yes, we want this soul, and therefore you put something in over the FA. I don't really want another quango, but... Or you break it up and say, separate out the area that is involved with the Premier League from that which is looking for the good of the football as a whole. Or you say, OK, we exempt the Premier League, their businesses, forget about them. And then we have a different body controlling it from down from there. And you legislate and fix the financial drop down, so that there is a proportion of those funds that are flowing in that always go to those level. But surely we have to have that debate, sure. And we're not really having it.
Let me pull two questions out of that. I mean, one is the debate, in the end, are football clubs businesses or are they something else? Right? Let's nail that one.
I think you just explained exactly what we've got at the moment, to be fair. I think we have got two separate methods. I think we've got the elite, professional, top of the tree, ultra business model. And do you know what, if you don't like it, go and watch Tranmere. Go and watch your local club lower down the leagues. There are options. I think actually football, to be honest, when we've kind of gone a direction here, and I always find myself pulling against any direction we're going in a debate to give someone else's point of view. The other point of view is there are options out there. Football will give you those options just now, and they are there. You know, you don't actually have to support Manchester United. You can support FC United of Manchester. You don't have to support Chelsea. You can support Brentford. You know, if you've been brought up... I know it's unthinkable for a lot of people, but I did change clubs. I supported one club and changed. I thought there were good enough reasons for it, and I did it. I grew to love the new club that I follow, and I'm so happy with it. I don't hate the club I left, but I just had a reason to change. And while we're in the midst of trashing football just now, the more football gets trashed and we all say it's terrible, immediately I get my hackles up slightly about that and think, no, wait a minute. Look, you have to be realistic in the middle of this. Have a look at the money that's coming into the exchequer in football, the amount of money that's getting paid in taxes by football that's getting recycled into this society of ours. It's not bad. I'm actually quite happy with that. It's big numbers, and we should be pleased about it. I would argue one of the best things that football's done has been a driver of the fight against bigotry, racism, sexism. I think it's been fantastic against people who have got disabilities. I think football's been a great driver of that. Because any time it's raised its ugly head, football, because it's a business, has no option, has to stand up, has to front it up. Now, my club that I support in England, Chelsea, just a few weeks ago, the utter embarrassment of what happened in Paris. Now, Chelsea stood up that day and did everything right. And I actually have no problem with Chelsea at all. Because you know what? If the club stands up and does everything right, and it keeps it as clean as it can within its own stadium boundaries, it's done all it can. What can you do if some people who you do not want involved you leech on? All you can do is fight against it as often as you can. I think football's been a driver. And I really feel that, and I'll have a dig at most newspapers and most media outlets about this, and it really annoys me. I've been fighting this for a long time. Football, anytime anything happens, you go, oh, football's a disgrace, it's got it all wrong, it's all this. Have a look on the pitch, for goodness sake. Have a look around the stands, for goodness sake. It's multicultural. We've worked really, really hard, and we don't stop working. And most of the kids now, when you see them listening to their players, have a look at before Champions League games. Everyone's got the banners up. We're all trying to say the same thing. So when we always say the negative things that are going on about football, I always kind of drag back a bit and go, no, wait a minute, steady on. Big business has got its good side as well within football. It's got its bad sides, and we kind of sometimes have to kind of swallow them slightly, but don't say it's all negative, because there's good sides. We have ploughed money back into facilities. We have ploughed money back into developing young players. They're working particularly well, I don't think, so far. But those other social issues that the game's working on, I'm proud of them. I'm actually proud of them, so... I know it doesn't always sit well with a lot of people.
Damien, let me throw the same question at you. I mean, in my limited experience of the world of business, one is that you try and make profits. And it's not clear to me, actually, for all this talk of commercialism, that is actually what's driving most owners in football. And as we know, overall, the Premier League, after tax and debt relief, loses money. Yeah. The Premier League doesn't make money. So if they are businesses, they're very odd kinds of businesses, aren't they? And shouldn't we think about them slightly differently as a consequence?
Yeah, I mean, some of the simple business rules apply. So if you want to win the Premier League, or if you want to win the Championship, or if you want to win the Women's Premier League, the chances are the team you put on the pitch will have about the highest wages in the league. It'll be there or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. So there is a commercial side to it, which is at any level, which is success has to be paid for somehow in giving you the players that you want. And I think the question about, you know, where should a club be? I mean, my local football club, or one of my local football clubs in the area I represent, Folkestone and Victor, they're in Ryman League South. The objective of the chairman of that club is they want the club to still be there in 5 years' time. You know, they want to put a team on the pitch, they want to play whatever level is appropriate, and they want it to be sustainable. There are a lot of clubs, I think, who are running that way further down. I think the supporters trust model is driving that as well, which is, you know, we don't want the kind of massive yo-yos and extremes. We want it to be sustainable. We want it to be good. We want the right atmosphere. We want to control the character of the club, and that's fine. We don't have an ambition to play beyond where we are. But I think if you're in the Premier League or at the higher end of it, then the commercial pressures are greater. The ambitions are higher. In some ways, I think I have a lot of sympathy with what Pat said. I mean, you know, in many ways, you'd much rather be dealing with some of the problems we've got in football now than the problems that we had in football 30 years ago, you know, where you've got stadiums that were falling to bits, you know, fans were staying away, you know, racism was sort of, you know, endemic, violence, you know, between fans, you know, people getting killed at matches. No money in the game of any real sense at all. And at least in some ways, football's strength, commercial strength now, gives it the gives it the power and the options to do something about some of the problems it faces. And I think, you know, through, you know, through some of the big clubs. I mean, I look at Manchester United, the club I support. I mean, I've got to know the people at the Manchester United Foundation really well. They do community work that football clubs never used to do before, and they're not alone in that. A lot of big clubs do it too. So having a commercial imperative for making money can be good if you use it for good things. I think what we've discussed so far this evening is there are elements of the game which could be improved and strengthened, that where governance reform could keep out some bad people that want to do bad things in football, could improve the way some clubs are run. And I think if we could pick off some of those areas for reform, that would be a big step forward.
So what are those areas?
Well, I think firstly, bad owners. I mean, that's something I think is often clubs that make poor commercial decisions have very bad owners with poor motives. I mean, I feel very strongly that this is an area where for governance reform, where legislation could play a role as well. I think if you look at the case of someone like the whole saga of Chelino at Leeds United, I think the FA should have the power to say, you know, because of your track record, because of what you've been involved in, we do not think you are someone who should own a football club in this country. And we've got special powers to say, until you can prove otherwise, you can't come in. But at the moment, we have a largely open door policy, which is if under UK company law, you can basically buy this club, you can buy that club. And actually, the owners and directors tests applied by the FA are not strong enough to keep that out. And the Football League in particular does not have the power to do it. I think that whilst the Premier League get a lot of stick, actually the Premier League have got a lot better at this because they have a higher embarrassment threshold. You know? They don't want badly run clubs in their league because it's bad for their image and their reputation. They want to keep them out. But I don't think the Football League have the resources. So I think if we could give the FA as the governing body the power to keep bad owners out of clubs, I think that we should always know who owns clubs. We should scrap these rules whereby people can own clubs through offshore trusts where the beneficial owners of the clubs are never known, never identified, and that has to step to end. And I think where a club's owner, it's clear they become bad. And I think, you know, Birmingham City under Carsten Jung is a good example of this. The president of the club is convicted of money laundering in Hong Kong. He then can't run the club, but the club can be controlled by a close group of his associates, including his son. We don't have any power to do anything about that if we don't like it. We're just stuck with it. That can't be right either. So I think these are some of the areas where you could have positive interventions to root out some of the bad apples, and that will go a long way, I think.
Gentleman there has been waiting for ages to ask a question.
Thanks. I'll just make a quick point, which goes back to when I originally put my hand up, and I'll come on to an actual question. It was just my good Arsenal friend here. David, you mentioned Dulwich Hamlet. That was the reason I put my hand up, because first and foremost, I'm a Sheffield United fan. Obviously, that's where I'm from. I moved to London 2 years ago, and a friend who lives in London introduced me to Dulwich Hamlet. And I've been going along regularly for quite a while now, and I would certainly recommend it if you enjoy just really good football, like-minded people who just want to be passionate on the terraces. You know, it's £10 on the door, on the turnstile. And it's interesting, just increasingly, I mean, attendances went up by 35% last season. An increasing proportion of those fans are, if you like, the disillusioned Premier League supporters that we've been talking about quite a lot this evening. For example, there's a guy I know who's, I think he's in his early 50s, he's got a couple of young kids. They can't really afford to go as a family to Stamford Bridge anymore. So they go to Dulwich Hamlet to watch, you know, just to enjoy the football. So anyway, that was just a point. So in a way, I'm kind of echoing what Pat said, where, you know, options. It's not all about the Premier League. I think that's perhaps a trap we can fall into in this country where, I mean, my dad told me that back in the day, match of the day, had one highlights package from the top flight, one from the old second division, one from the old third division. That's way before I can remember match of the day, but perhaps we've just fall into this trap of everything's about the Premier League. Anyway, the question is, just to put a slight twist on the question that's on the screen, and it's kind of going back to the national team, is big money ruining the English national team? And the reason I ask it is because, of course, the England team, apart from 1966, have never been particularly successful before or since the introduction of the Premier League. You know, we didn't qualify for a World Cup in the 1970s, for example, which is often looked back as a glorious decade of stylish play in the top flight. So to what extent is big money ruining the English national team, or are other factors at play, specifically on the national team?
I do think you've got a massive problem, because as I said before, I watched it happen in Scotland. It's happening here too. It's a very simple thing. You've got a finite period of time where you can be a professional footballer. You've got an even less, a smaller period of time where you're going to be a top professional footballer. So you have to cram that in that period of time. It's the 10,000 hours argument. It's the argument of you doing the best for the longest time. If you're playing in England and you're one of the best young players, you will probably get picked up by one of the top teams. So you will go there because you'll be very excited and you've been bred into being the best. You will go there. The chances of you getting into that first team before you are 21 are astronomically low. There's no hope. Almost no hope at all. They may farm you out, which is a good thing. If you're not playing first team football and playing it regularly by the time you're 18, 19, at the outside 20, and preferably at the top level, you ain't going to be a top international class player. And I mean that, someone who's going to really do it in the top stage. Have a look at Neymar, when did he start? Have a look at Messi, when did he start? Have a look at them all the way through. They were playing top class, first class football then. Doesn't happen in England. The reason being, you hit the ceiling. You're going to get there, and no, you're a great centre-forward, but we happen to have, you know, the French centre-forward playing there, the Colombian centre-forward playing there. You're not going to get there. And it seems to happen in very specific positions, centre-forward being one of them. Now, at the moment, wonderfully, there's a couple of young lads coming through in English football, and it's really, really exciting, but it's been a long time coming. But it's a smaller pool than you've ever had. It's much, much smaller than you've ever had, who get to the top, get in the first team, and learn it. Harry Kane's broke through. He's got there. It's one of an incredibly small number, and it's because there's no spaces there. Now, I'm not advocating no foreign players in the Premier League. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying you've got to take the rough for the smooth. If you want that kind of league, if you want to enjoy it, if you want to enjoy the money, the excitement, the entertainment it brings, do you know what? Your England team ain't going to be as good.
Why has England national team been successful in the past when there was a high proportion of English players playing in the top flight?
They were certainly better then. I think they were a better chance then. I may be talking slightly out of turn. For quite a few years, I read the newspapers in England. Every time England got to a World Cup final, and the amount of people were saying that this is a year, we're going to win it, we've got this. And everybody outside is going, eh? What are you talking about? Miles away. You know, but everybody outside, I'm Scottish, I'm not anti-English. Just going Scottish down me a minute. But looking at it going, no, you're a good distance away for that. There's a lot better teams than you out there. But it didn't seem to hit home until Brazil. Maybe the one before it as well. Well, actually, we're not. I would say there was a period before that when you thought, actually, you know what? Got half a wee chance here. I don't think that's been the case for quite a long time. A real long time. People talked often about the golden generation. There were some wonderful players in that golden generation. Some of them weren't as good as you thought they were. Some of them were, but some of them weren't anywhere near as good as you thought they were. And that was maybe the insular view from within the English football at the time. I think that was the problem. I have to be brutally honest about it. Good players, but wasn't a great team.
And were they not a great team as well? Is there an extent to which in England, I just never seen the team...
You're going to ask me to be a pundit now. We're not here to be a pundit.
It's not a punditry question. Yeah. It's genuinely a question of public and collective stuff.
I thought you'd won... from the outside, I thought you'd won major problem. You had one massive problem. Far too... And it's a problem that's... I think you can maybe trace back to the Premier League as well, to some degree. Hell of a lot of time spent on the star structure. Mm. Hell of a lot of time spent on... I suppose we're all in this world now. We're interested in celebrity and celebrity culture. And the amount of people told me that David Beckham was the best player, the best players in the world, and I'm lying about my back laughing my head off, saying, he's all right, he's a decent player, he's all right. You know, he's not saying he's the best player in the world. You stuck him in the right side. Sorry, it's technical, but you stuck him in the right side, okay? David's never ran by a player in his life, okay? Then you stick some... It's true. and it goes in the left. In the left side, you've not got a left-footed player, so he runs inwards, right? So you're not going anywhere. So you're just static. You're playing 4-4-2, so you get two guys in the middle, and you put Lampard and Gerrard in there, and you go, oh, they're terrible. They can't play together. And I'm sitting going, they run beyond people when you make space. Your problem's out there. And everyone can. And I've sat and watched and read, you know, lots of chin-stroking articles about your problem was these two couldn't play together. They were the answer. They were sitting there in front of you. Your problem was out there, and you blew it. Year after year, World Cup after World Cup. And it's because you had this celebrity culture, you couldn't see past it. Everybody on the outside was going, yeah, we kind of know what you're doing. And it was, so it was a technical reason. I think you had lots of good players. Absolutely didn't use them the best way. By the way, Beckham was great, by the way. Really good player, really nice guy. Fantastic, because I'll get battered with tweets. No, I won't. I got off Twitter about 2 weeks ago. But in actual fact, it's not saying anything on the fact he was a decent player. But you, the amount of people that tell me, I got asked a question really recently, is he one of the top three players that ever played?
Those who've already asked the question, I'm aware you're dying to come back, but I'm just going to try and include a few folks who haven't asked a question yet, and then I'll come back to you, promise, if there's time. Gentleman in the far corner, and then these two gentlemen down here.
Hi, question for Damien. Has the FA failed to reform, even being asked to by the select committees and previous governments, what would persuade the current government or the next government to step in and legislate to protect the game?
Well, I think the best chance we've got of that, and I put forward my own bill to House Commons, you know, with ideas of where I think we could, there's a case for legislation. And the case I make is that I think people in politics feel that, you know, sport is a sort of private matter and it shouldn't be regulated by the government. I think that is right. But I think what you can look at are things that have been allowed to happen in football, which almost no one else in any other area of national life could get away with, or where the regulation is failing. And the FA don't have the power to do anything about it, and therefore we have grounds for stepping in. So I think creating this new sort of backed up by statute test on owners and directors, we have that actually in broadcasting. You know, Ofcom can take away the license from a broadcaster if they feel they're not following the law or the code, and they can refuse to issue one. So we've done it in other areas of national life, so we could do it with sport. Getting rid of things like the football creditors rule, so when a club goes bust, all the football debts are paid in full and everyone else gets nothing. There's no other area of business where you could do that. All unsecured creditors are treated equally and fairly. There's no special deal for one set or another. I think we could look at doing that. So I think you could look at some of these specific areas and say, you know, that actually there's a strong case for legislation. There's no reason why football couldn't sort it out itself. But if it continually refuses to do it, and I think there's a consensus that it's damaging the game, then that's where we could and should intervene. I also think as well we should have a bold national strategy to say, that involves not just the government, you know, but football and everyone else, to say our ambition should be to have the same quality and level of community sports facilities as countries like Germany. And we should have a national plan to get there. You know, and that may require more funding from football, some support from government, support from planning, better coordination between schools and community sports clubs. There'll be lots of answers to that problem. But I look at what Greg Dyke has done with his report. I think it's great, but it's nowhere near ambitious enough. We should be much more ambitious. We've got the resources in this country to achieve that, and that is something else we should do as well. I think government is part of that. I think the government has done some good work in that area, but I think we should be a lot bolder.
Is that enough for you as a programme of reform, or do you want more?
Well, you know, I've introduced
the FA have shown themselves as ineffective.
Yeah.
You know, and when is the government going to keep to their word and step in to try and
protect supporters? Well, personally, you know, I have introduced the bill on the floor of the House two or three times now, and I know there's a lot of support across Parliament for it. To be honest with you, I think the conditions that allow it to take place would not be something where it would probably be a big government bill, but where it would be the government would allow measures to come through that clearly have the support of people right across Parliament. And I think there are lots and lots more people that feel that way. And all I would say to fans is lobby your Member of Parliament, ask them what they're doing about it.
Gentleman over here.
The question the gentleman just asked is actually very similar to the one I was going to ask. But one thing I'd be interested to know your thoughts on, and you know, maybe not if it's going to bore everyone else, but I'm a Leeds fan, and I really respected the Football League for actually, I thought, standing up and implementing their legislation. However, at the same time, like many fans of Leeds, Chiellino is the best thing that's come along to us because he actually had money. And if you ask the local businesses, they're getting paid on time, for example. And these were the guys that missed out. So that one piece of legislation on owners and directors has been incredibly difficult for them to actually realise in reality. Do you think your bill or the government really realises the kind of complexities of the practicalities of implementing these things?
I think you've got to have good rules on governance. I think if you've got someone looking to come in and buy a club from whoever it is, be it British or from somewhere else around the world, and you say they've got previous convictions for fraud, even if they're spent, even if it wouldn't stop them buying a normal business in this country, but they've got previous convictions, they've got certain sort of, it's not clear where they're getting their money from, or it's not clear who all their backers are, it doesn't quite add up. I think we should have the power to say, no, I'm sorry. And I think that should be, the reason I think the FA should have that power is they're not as commercially linked to the clubs as the leagues are, where the clubs are shareholders. And the fans also, as you say, well, they will welcome someone who's bringing money in. But I think there has to be a guardian, and that should probably be the FA to say, sorry, it doesn't quite stack up. I think the reason clubs in the Championship in particular, I think, have been particularly prone to this, or bigger clubs maybe in League One, is that they've got no money, and they're really, the owners have been struggling to sell the club to get an injection of capital in. They will almost look at any gift horse that comes along. And I think sometimes one of the purposes of having a governing body is someone can step in and say, I know this may look attractive to you now, but we don't think it stacks up. And actually, it's in your best interest you don't do this, and we've got the power to stop it. And I think at the moment, it falls down. I think what was crazy with Chiellino and Leeds was the league clearly didn't want him. And then it was challenged by Chiellino to say, well, actually, you haven't got the power to stop it. So then he came in, and then the Italian legal system sort of clicked through another gear, and he is found guilty of what he'd been charged of. So then the whole thing's thrown up in the air again. And that is, we've got to have power to do something about that. I think we've got to have the power to stop that.
Just one line on that as well. Up in Scotland just now, Rangers, who have had utter nightmares with owners. It was unthinkable. I mean, it's unimaginable for Scotsmen to see what's happened to that club. But they feel as if the fans... It feels as if they're out of it just now. It feels as if finally they've seen the light at the end of the tunnel. A gentleman's come in, he's taken over it, and he's had fraud convictions in South Africa. Under certain rules, he wouldn't have got in. Rangers would be back at square one. So, you know, for the fans, it's crushing. Rangers have got out of it, but they might not have.
There might be someone else.
And then, by the way, he might end up being a dreadful owner and as bad as White before him. Who knows? We don't know yet. Time will only tell in that. But that's the difficult thing. When you make really hard and fast rules, clubs that have fallen in difficult times or whatever, for any reason, you may well stop the one chance they had. And that's a shame.
OK, we've got 10 minutes to go, which, as we know, statistically, is the period in which most mistakes are made, most goals are scored. So let's keep it, keep them coming fast to the panel, if you can keep your questions short, and I'm going to take a couple together. This gentleman in the stripes, this gentleman on the corner, then the gentleman next to him, and then I'll come back to Mr. Sampaoli at the back, who I know is itching to get back to us. We'll take these three questions, make them brief. Sir?
I'm a QPR fan. So I've seen big money ruin my club over the last few years. When we get relegated at the end of the season, do you think an example needs to be made of a club like QPR that's been run like a circus off the pitch, on the pitch, by relegating them to the bottom of the pyramid to send a deterrent out to other clubs who are sort of tempted to do the same?
OK, fearsome punishments for foolishness. What do we think? So on the corner, and then the gentleman next to you. I'm going to take these all together.
Okay, thank you. I work in sports media, so I benefit from the wealth of the game, so I don't have a problem with that. My question is about the legacy and what will be left after the Premier League. Once that deal will kick off, the new deal, Burnley will be richer than Ajax or Benfica, subject to them staying in the Premier League, of course. But then again, you won't believe, I mean, the scenario in which you can drop 50,000 tourists to go to their games. The backbone of every club are the members. We are the members' club at the moment ourselves. So that's also, you know, shows that even the Guardian recognizes the need for that.
What's the question?
The question is about the commodity. When the Premier League becomes a commodity, which we seems to be agreeing on that, it will be out of fashion at some point. Once it's out of fashion, what will be left after the Premier League? What's the legacy that will left? And the example of Serie A that Pat has brought earlier, maybe drawing some, you know, examples.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, I'm from Poland, so I will take my question slowly, not to make too many mistakes. I would like to refer to what Pat said about youth players. I've been speaking recently with Tom Hatley, who's playing in Polish Football League. I'm a journalist, so we took an interview about also the topic we are discussing here. And he said that there is a ceiling, obviously, but there is also a huge comfort zone given to young players. He didn't make it at Reading Academy because he felt that he has it all, that he is earning enough, that he is making it all. He was released with seven other players when Steve Koppel left, and he didn't make it in England. He went to Scotland and then to Poland. This is obviously linked with what Gregory Dyke proposes, then to make the limits for the youth British players up from 8 to 12 players. Will it make this comfort zone for youth players bigger, or actually make by increasing more space, obviously, in the squads, or perhaps it solves some part of the problem of the level of English football?
Duncan, I'm going to pass QPR fearsome punishments for foolishness. Should we have them?
I don't think so, because I think that the punishment happens in it, you know, automatically, doesn't it, really? But I think that financial fair play will have an impact on that over a period of time in terms of people coming in and just trying to artificially boost clubs up through leagues. But I do think we've still got this problem with clubs acting in a sustainable way and, you know, rather than taking reckless gambles, which, you know, we've seen at Leeds and Portsmouth, who said, and effectively that's what's happened at QPR really as well. And I think that is something that's going to have to be. I think in Germany they have a kind of an audit of clubs so that they have to operate in a certain way, and there's almost a sustainability test. And I think that's the sort of thing we could have. But again, I don't have confidence that the FA could regulate that, unfortunately. You know, I think they might need some new body, or the FA will need some expertise coming in from one of the financial service regulators or something like that. But, yeah, I think the sustainability requirement is something that we should have put on our clubs in a similar way to the German model.
Damien, I'm going to offer legacy to you. One day the Premier League will disappear into thin air when it falls out of fashion, and what will be left from all of this, and how can we assure an alternative?
I don't quite agree with that, but the Premier League will sort of come to an end. Like I said, what Pat said about Serie A, there are some, I think in many ways the English football clubs are on a slightly firmer footing than some of the big Italian clubs were. They largely own their own stadia. You know, the commercial revenues are very strong. If there's I think the global TV audience for English football will only grow, and the revenues will come from that. There is something we've not talked about, which I think is really interesting, though, is that it's not just about the Premier League. It's really the elite European clubs, the clubs that are part of the European Clubs Association. That's where the money is going. It's not just the Premier League. It's the really big European clubs. And that is having quite a distorting effect on the whole of European football, because the chances of a club like Feyenoord or Anderlecht or Malmo or not, you know, a lot, Celtic, you know, contesting the Champions League, you know, are virtually zero. I mean, really, you've got the Champions League winners really coming from a relatively small pool of clubs, and that consolidation of commercial power accelerating. So it's not just the Scottish Premier League that is a victim of that. Other European leagues are as well. And what is the future for European football as well? You know, are we just going to see all the money being consolidated into a dozen or so really enormous clubs, which are really global brands that just happen to be in Europe? And what happens to everyone else? And that's bigger than, you know, the future. What happens after the Premier League? That is a structural issue that I think is a really big challenge for UEFA. At the moment, I've not seen really any evidence that they've found a solution to it.
Pat, youth quotas, do they work?
Possibly. Can I first talk about your comfort zone point? The young player who said that if you get other young players in and you're giving them 5, 6, 7 grand a week and they get in their comfort zone, they get lazy and they don't maximise the potential, they were never going to make it anyway. They didn't have the right mental spirit to do it. So they can use that as an excuse if you like. In actual fact, the real people who have the right attitude towards it, the money wasn't the driving force. The other things was the driving force. Anything in this life, you do something for fear, you do something for money, or you do something for the love of it, particularly if it's creative, there's only one winner. The one that you do for the love of it is going to win it through. Just have a look at Messi. Just have a look at Ronaldo. That's how you do it. So there was a weakness, a character weakness to get to the elite level for having that. So, yeah, they may have been getting a lot of money and they may have been wasted, but it's not the reason why I didn't make it. The money is actually the character weakness. It's the reason why I didn't make it. Quotas. I would make one quota change if I can take it slightly away from that. One quota change. If it's at all possible to go back to a time where there was the limits that there are imposed just now should be increased. I think you should, if it's at all possible, get to a point where the top leagues, you should have about roughly half of your squad should be homegrown. I would like that to be the case. Can't see it happening. In fact, it won't happen. I quite like it. Because it would keep it more national.
Can I ask one of the ideas I was quite interested in Greg Dyke's report was, I think it was one that system they have in Holland where for non-EU players, you have a minimum salary. So you say, if you want to bring someone in, a young player from Brazil, that's fine, but you've got to play them like a top player. You can't bring them in on a development wage.
It's kind of the same here anyway, with, you know, if you actually have to get a work permit. The work permits are hard to get in the UK anyway. I mean, I've been on the work permits committee in Scotland and in England as well. You better be good. Mm. You better be any good, and you better have some international cats behind you, because otherwise you're not going to get in. It's, the bar's fairly high in that.
Final two-minute goal-mouth scramble. Mr. Sampaoli, Mr. Burnley, and then we're going to have to leave it there.
Very quickly, Duncan, you said that it won't work, what I was talking about earlier, starting again. It will work. The proof is in the pudding. So long as people are backing it, and I believe that there's enough people in this country that will back it, there's enough disillusioned fans that will back it. AFC Wimbledon did it, FC United did it, with only thousands of fans, not millions. There's at least a million men in this country, and maybe women as well, that just can't stand what's going on at the moment.
Pat, okay, I'm going to have to hold you there because we are in the final minute. So the spirit of optimism in football is still alive. Mr. Burnley, final question. Keep it short, please, sir.
The final thing I was going to say was someone mentioned the English national team earlier, and I was just going to say I live in Scotland. I also support the Scottish national team over England. My family's all Scottish. Craig Levein was the Scotland manager about 5 years ago, and actually he's been reported as being a terrible manager for the Scottish national team. On the pitch, they did terribly. He also brought in a youth system in Scotland.
Question.
There is a question. He brought in a youth system in Scotland, which I think in 10 years' time is going to benefit the national team massively, which might have been to the detriment of the national team at the time. If England did the same and had a proper leader in charge who would do something similar, England might have half a chance in 20 years of winning World Cup. What does Pat and the rest of the panel think about that?
The sadness for anyone who develops youth development, the ones who fail, no one owns up to them. The guy who comes through and becomes a star, he's got 10 fathers. He's got 10 people who have said it was them that we brought them through. And Craig will be one of these people that's going to sadly have to deal with that. And he will know himself how much effect he had. Others may not be aware of it. And sadly, that's the sadness of youth development. But you don't do it for the fame. You don't do it for notoriety. Do it for the love of the game.
I'm going to finish on that note on 90 Minutes with the thought of the love of the game. If you just put your hands together and thank our panel, and thank you very much for coming.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.